I think we are ready to start with our next discussion, which is principles of disclosure. And I give the floor to Catherine.
Thank you, Hans. Okay, good morning, everybody. So we had a really exciting month on the principles of disclosure in March. The board made a lot of decisions, and they've got a good number of further decisions to make over the coming months, and it is some of those upcoming decisions that we'd like to ask for your advice on today. I'm going to take a couple of minutes now just to summarise the context of where we are within the overall project before talking about the particular things that we are seeking your advice on in this meeting. So the first three slides on 4, 5 and 6 summarise broadly what happened in March. So you probably recall from the December session we have with you that the board received a lot of advice about project focus and direction, and were generally encouraged to prioritise, which is exactly what they did. So slide 4 summarises a number of areas that the board decided they would not pursue further within the principles of disclosure, either because they will instead be considered within primary financial statements, or because in the broad scheme of things they're considered to be relatively lower priority and are more things to spend time on. Slide 5 then summarises what the board are planning to do as next steps. So in the first instance, they're planning to develop a set of guidance for the board to improve the way that disclosure requirements are developed and drafted in the future. They see that as something of an iterative process, a first step in improving the way that things are done. So concurrently with developing that guidance, we are also going through an exercise of selecting one or two standards to use as a test to apply the guidance on, both with a view to making that guidance as useful as possible and to improve the disclosure requirements in the identified standards. Ultimately, with that exercise, we will be looking to publish an exposure draft to ask for feedback on both the process and the proposed improvements to the standards that are picked. Now, all of that work is currently ongoing. The team are working hard on moving that forward. And at this stage, we do anticipate coming to ASAF to discuss that in detail and to ask for your advice at the next meeting in July of this year. That said, we will be happy to take any questions if you have them about that process. However, the area that we would like to ask for your advice on today is those topics that are still subject to next step decisions over the next couple of months. So on slide 6, you can see the areas that remain after the two things that I just summarised. And these are essentially topics that are well supported and that people would like the board to pursue, but that there are some quite particular challenges that the board need to think about whether and how they can address if they are to move forward. So it's the first two of those areas, location of information and accounting policy disclosures, that we'd like to ask for your advice on today. With regard to both of those topics, we are intending to bring those back to the board in June for discussion, but between now and that meeting, the staff are doing a reasonable amount of outreach and further research to get more information on the things we feel we need for the board to be able to make informed next step decisions. So there's essentially three sets of questions today, so we'll take them one at a time. The first set relates to a location of information topic, specifically IFRS information outside the financial statements. Now, we purposefully prepared quite detailed slides today, so I'm not going to talk through everything that's on those slides, just to summarise broadly what we'd like to talk about. There is overall support for the board developing guidance or requirements about companies disclosing IFRS information outside the financial statements and cross-referencing it in. However, there are some quite specific concerns about that we need to consider whether we can address. And the particular ones that we'd like to talk to you about today are those that relate to concerns about the potential interaction of anything that the board might do with jurisdictional laws and regulations. So we heard a number of views in the comment letters that could be a potential problem. And on slides 10 and 11, we've got a number of the concerns that were identified in the comment letters. And on slide 12, we've got examples of solutions or potential solutions that have been put forward. the further information that the board feel they need to be able to decide on next steps here is a step more detail about exactly what those potential problematic interactions with jurisdictional requirements are, and advice about whether they can be solved to the extent that any requirements or guidance the board might develop would be more helpful than problematic. So the questions we have on slide 13 essentially come down to those two things, i.e. are these problems existing in your jurisdictions? And if they are you able to give us specific examples of the kinds of laws and regulations that the board should be thinking about? And if that is the case, do you have any advice about potential solutions, either whether those on slide 12 would be useful or whether you have any other ideas about how the board should best move forward with this topic? So I will we'll pause there for discussion of the questions on slide 13.
I suppose if members have a question about the first six pages, that they could also ask.
Yes,
that,
yes,
right?
Of course.
Yeah. Okay. Alberto.
Thank you. Yeah, we are skeptical of giving information outside the annual report by means of cross referencing. For a number of reasons. Although you have addressed some of this concern, this information must be available same time, same terms, continue to be available, cannot change, but still, you know, it makes an annual report, the information contained as a whole in the document a bit cumbersome, you know. You have to go somewhere else, and then maybe somewhere else again, but this has a domino effect. Also, I mean, in my jurisdiction, I believe in other European jurisdiction, the annual report is a legally defined document. And there are many consequences about this. I can track responsibilities about, false statement or misleading statement. It's used for determining the minimum capital requirement, the distribution of dividends. So, I mean, we believe that should still be a self-contained document. No information which are not necessary, non-IFRS information, they are not necessary. Because if they are necessary to give a true and fair view, then there should be a requirement at the end. If all yet something, and normally a better picture, that this is what generally the non-financial information are used to give a better picture or a better description of the business, then should be left outside if they are not there for necessary for give to a fair view. At the same time, what is necessary for to a fair view should stay there and not somewhere else by way of cross-reference.
Jim?
So you asked about legal impediments. I think in the U.S. we've found audit impediments, whether they're legal or not, they're certainly impediments in terms of cross-referencing outside of the financial statements. I think that would continue to exist. Concerns about exactly when you're cross-referencing outside of the financial statements, what is then within the scope of the audited set or not? And I think it's sometimes easier than others when you start cross-referencing out is, are you taking responsibility for the entirety of that page or that set of data? And so I think that would continue, at least in our environment, as we've thought about it, to be an impediment. But since it would be permitted and not required, I mean, it's whether you want to look at those at each jurisdiction or not. Again, that the permission might just be enough to foster that growth in other areas, and then the U.S. can figure out that this isn't as scary as maybe people think, and it can be done. The terms, I think, are helpful, although I wonder if some of them will be 10, 20, 30 years from now, terms like single document. If you're thinking electronically, what is a single document? Is an appendix or some other piece of that thing a single document or not? Terms like cannot be changed, I'm not sure what that means. If physically cannot be changed or will not be changed, so I think pretty much anything can be changed. It's whether or not it will be changed. So just thinking about the tightness of those terms as you're trying to identify. The annual report itself can obviously be changed if you need to restate for errors. So seemingly you have to have the ability to change if there were an error in that IFRS information. So I think conveying what it is that you're trying to convey a little more, perhaps a little more crisply with that one. And I think otherwise this seems like tying it back to, you know, you state the disclosure problem. And I, as I read that, I kept struggling with, is there a crisp articulation of what the problem statement is? And then how does this actually address that? Or is this just something, even this, you know, if the problem is not enough disclosure about key areas, how does this help with the problem? If the problem is too much disclosure in extraneous information, again, how does this really help with what it is that the problem statement is? And I found that lacking of tying this piece of the work back to any particular problem statement.
You?
Thank you. We have some similar comments with Jim. I just want to highlight two things. The first one is the IFRS information outside the financial statements. The big concern is from the auditors. Because in China, we have a specific definition of financial statement in Chinese accounting standards. And the regulators like CSRC, they develop some disclosure requirements on annual report for listed companies. And all the financial statements, which is included in the annual report, should be audited by the accounting firms. So the auditors raise the concerns that what is the boundary of the auditing if IFRS information was outside the financial statement. That's the first point. The second point is about the question number three. In slide 12, there are four potential solutions. We are in supportive of the number four solutions, that is D, which allows some flexibility in different jurisdictions, and preparers can use judgment in practice and disclose necessary information outside the financial statement in a suitable way, and the standards setters in different jurisdictions or some regulators in different jurisdictions can have some requirement according to the local laws or regulations.
Linda?
Thanks. So just want to make the point that in Canada, there is no definition of annual report. Now, traditionally, the annual report consists of the management commentary, we call it MD&A, and the financial statements, including the notes, but there's no legal definition. And in our jurisdiction, there is no requirement for the financial statements and the MD&A to be filed at the same time. However, there is a practice that is best practice, where the larger reporters for sure will file all of their continuous disclosure requirements at the same time. And that's quite broad spread in terms of those that are most active. There's also another form called the annual information form that could be considered to be part of the annual report. There is no requirement for that to be filed at the same time, and traditionally that's not filed at the same time. However, we're looking at a regulatory review right now to reduce regulatory burden, so maybe we can make some progress on that. I'm not sure. But so there is that particular issue, and I'd like to support what's already been said, that a key issue in this regard is what we hear from the audit firms and their desire for us not to do anything that removes the clarity of what exactly is covered by their audit opinion. So I noticed in the materials you referred to dialogue with the International Auditing Board, but in Canada that's probably okay because, in essence, we adopt international auditing standards. We have a few additional requirements in Canada outside of those, but but you may need to talk to other bodies as well if a particular jurisdiction isn't following the international auditing standards. So you just need to be aware of that. On slide 12, I just want to reiterate some of the comments that have already been made. We think some of this is helpful. I talked about availability at the same time. I don't think continue to be available is a problem in item B, but want to reiterate the notion of cannot be changed, because for a lot of the reasons that Jim mentioned, the documents in particular, if there's a review, the MD&A could get changed as a result of a continuous disclosure review, et cetera. And so we find that one a bit problematic in terms of what your intentions are. We don't think this should stop you from pursuing this, but we just want to reiterate that we might have to work our way through it and deal with it on a jurisdictional basis, which we would stand ready to deal with the securities regulators in our jurisdiction to assist it, because I think all too often we say, well, this is my silo, I'm the standard setter, and then there's the securities regulator silo. I think those silos have to come down if financial reporting practices are going to be more effective. So we all got to get in there and play our part. But I just would say there are some issues that we need to overcome depending on where you're going with this. But I think one of the biggest issues is the lack of clarity you might have to deal with on what's covered by the audit opinion. And in particular, users tell us they want to know what's covered and what's not covered. So you've got to keep that in mind.
Kimberly?
There's a sort of question about sort of any local legal barriers. I mean, we do have a definition in New Zealand company legislation of annual report. I don't actually think it would be problematic, and I guess whether it is or isn't depends on whether you retain that term anyway. And in our comment letter on the discussion paper, we were not supportive anyway of that idea of constraining it to the annual report. We were particularly thinking, as you know, as has already been mentioned, future proofing this, you know, with changes in the way that people access information, with changes in technology, that the idea of a single document, is that really going to exist anymore anyway? So we would rather go down the track of, you know, so we're not really supportive of option A in your solutions of retaining that idea. We would rather go down the second option you've got there, because we think that you should be permitted to cross-reference, but we recognise it's important to have constraints around that. And so some of the things you've identified there are consistent with our views on what you need to do in order to provide those constraints. Probably the only other point to emphasise, as has been mentioned already, is around the auditing requirements. Both New Zealand and Australia, we use the international standards on auditing, so working in with those ISAs would be obviously very important from our perspective as well.
Andreas.
Thanks. I certainly echo the comments of Jim with regard to technology and the impact of digital reporting. I think talking about a document may work fine for the time being, but may not work in 5 or 10 years or even sooner. I think if the audit is an issue, and it seems to be an issue, and we have heard that as well, is that not a case for getting together with IFAC? Because they must have had the same issue. I mean, if the reporting goes digital, then at some stage the audit will go digital as well. Mm-hmm. So they must have the same issue. And is there not a strong case to actually team up with them? In terms of an example of information that's non-IFRS information that is required to be disclosed in the financial statements and the notes, I can give you director's remuneration. Mm-hmm. That's a requirement. Has nothing to do with IFRSs, but it has to be disclosed in the notes and the financial statements, and there's no way of bypassing that.
Andrew?
In the position we took in our comment letter on the discussion paper was, I think, similar to item B on slide 12. But I think Jim and Linda do make good points about sort of reality checking the words cannot be changed. But we were in that overall territory. I have to say this was one of the more difficult areas to get to a position on, and the input was quite mixed during our outreach, which was extensive. But overall, that's where we ended up. It partly was, I do think that, notwithstanding that in some jurisdictions, annual report might be defined as, even within Europe, it actually does have a different meaning to some extent in different jurisdictions. The accounting directive defines a management report and financial statements, and quite what's in this annual reporting package, I think, does differ in practice. So approach B does seem to avoid these definitional issues about trying to define particular documents, as well as debatably being somewhat more future-proofed and responsive to innovations in digital reporting and the greater integration of financial and non-financial information. We certainly heard some concerns from representatives of the audit community, none which I heard to be insuperable barriers, but some concerns along the lines of this could add, extensive cross-referencing could add cost and complexity to the audit. But even that wasn't a uniform message from the audit community. I would say others were more along the lines of if this is a way of improving communication and reducing duplication, the audit profession should find a way of facilitating these improvements and not standing in the way. So perhaps mixed messages, but that's kind of where I stand on this. And finally, yeah, I think the approach, all these approaches being contemplated, are facilitative. It probably is a practical reality that there will be some jurisdictional traditions and perhaps some jurisdictional regulations which might place constraints on the extent to which that facilitation could be deployed in practice. Well, so be it, and that happens in all kinds of other contexts. There is an interaction between the requirements of IFRS and then jurisdictional requirements and traditions on filing, on placement, on production of the report in the first place. And I don't think the ISB can manage all of that, so as long as what you're doing is not mandatory, I would hope that would be manageable with the interaction with jurisdictional requirements.
Noble?
Yes, thank you. In our jurisdiction, the term annual report does not necessarily mean documents to be filed under law, and therefore we generally agree with the ISB's direction not to use the term annual report in the principles. But as some have already mentioned, we do not support A in slide 12 to change that word to single document for the reasons that others have mentioned. In terms of cross-referencing, we do not necessarily disagree with doing so, but we do think there needs to be some constraints, and I think B is a good starting point for the restrictions for cross-referencing.
Patrick?
The term annual report is a term which could require more definition, because in Europe, as Andrew said, the directive is saying you have the management report, you have the financial statements. In addition, you have the transparency directive, which is giving guidance on what is the amount of information, including management report and financial statements, but including other information that you need to disclose when you are listed. So annual report in that context is not very, very clear as to the scope, extent. Some people have extensive annual reports, what they call, their document, or reference document, whatever they call it. Other people restrict themselves to, in particular when they are not listed, to just the management report and the financial statements. That being said, I think I have no nostalgia for paper and for you find everything in one place, in a document that you can put in your bookshelf and you can have access to and read page 12 or page 122. But it had its advantages because you were sure of what was financial information or financial reporting. That created clarity. So all the questions which are introduced by digitalization, by the use of cross-referencing, by dissemination of information in a number of places, creates that challenge for us, I think. Because, and not only to the auditors, I think also to the users, because the users need to know what is a standardized financial information. They need to know what is in it, what is not in it, what has a different attribute. So we need to find a system whereby the attributes of the information that is disseminated is very clear. Either it's part of the financial information, so why not cross-referencing, but it's complex. I would accept, personally, I would accept cross-referencing because I think it's inevitable. But I would like to find, I do not mind redundancy to a certain extent. Why not? I mean, in the world of digitalization, I have twice the same information. One moment in the management report, one moment elsewhere, as long as I know what is the perimeter of what I call the financial information. So coherence for me of financial information and a cohesiveness, a comprehensive approach to financial information has to be protected. If not, we're going to find so many sources of financial information that users, and not only auditors, are going to be lost.
Something to be said for that. Simpler.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay. Thank you. So in Korea, the annual report is issued after issuing the financial statement, so cross-reference between two documents is impossible.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Rodrigo.
I'd like to share some information about Brazil. In Brazil, we have more than 8 different regulators. Each one of them has a different opinion of view, so a different accounting, so a different requirement. Sometimes we have to produce a consolidate with everything together, and it's a big challenge for us. Other points about the auditors. We have been trying to have the integrated report audited. It's a simple truth. We are trying to do that for 4 years, and I can say it's almost impossible because you have non-gap information and gap information in the same document. And auditors can't produce a unique, a complete opinion about this document. The opinion is only about the financial information. And when I have this information in different documents or it's difficult to have this information together, I have to pay more for the auditors.
I think it might be helpful if I sum up by topic gives rise to any further thoughts. So I'll sum up what we have heard on IFRS information outside the financial statements before moving on to the next topic. So I think key things coming through in terms of what we are taking from this as the major concerns. Firstly, of course, I think there was pretty much consensus in the room about the concerns about the interaction with audit and auditors' responsibilities. Just to let you know that we have got a number of strands of work going on in this area at the moment. So we have been talking to the IAASB, as was mentioned in the board meeting itself. I think we've had some good advice in this meeting potentially about talking to other audit bodies as well. So we will certainly look to take some of that on board and act on it, because we do realise there are some substantial concerns there, and we are going to make sure we bottom those out before bringing this back to the board. I think in terms of concerns with jurisdictional laws and regs. There were quite a lot of different comments on the annual report and the way that that is, what that term means in different jurisdictions, that I think wonderfully demonstrated the challenge that the board has, because we heard that in some jurisdictions it's a legal term, in some jurisdictions it's not a legal term, in some jurisdictions it's published after the financial statements. So we've heard quite a range of different things, which does help us in terms of bringing the problem home, and in terms of what we should do about that. I think, again, there were mixed views in the room, with a couple of people generally not supporting cross-referencing, a number supporting it, but supporting the B approach of applying principles and constraining how it's used. I think the general impression we get on option A, which is looking at the term single document, is that it's generally not supported, both for reasons of the challenges around technology and the challenges around the definition of documents. So we will take all of that feedback and use it in moving forward. I'll also highlight the fact that we've heard a number of concerns about technology, and just again to let the room know that the strand of consideration around technology and how it interacts with this project is a whole piece of work within itself. So that's certainly something we are working through a plan of how to move forward on. So I think those were the key things. But yeah, we heard a number of jurisdiction specifics, which again we will use in taking next step decisions to the board.
Part of modern technology is that copy and paste is very easy to do, which brings me somewhat sympathetic towards what Patrick said. Just to accept a little bit of doubling and avoid all these very complicated questions might be the simplest way to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thought, because, I mean, one of the questions we had, or one of the comments that we had, was about how this area of the project interacts with the original problem. And interestingly, the very way that it interacts is that those that support it are very keen on companies having the ability to keep similar information together. So if you've got similar information in a management commentary in the annual report, allowing it to be in the same place would avoid repetition, duplication, and help with sort of better communication and telling the story. So it's almost a flip to the doubling of points.
So I didn't understand.
So I was just explaining that the way many of those that support this support it, because it helps to avoid sort of duplication and information that arguably is redundant because it's in multiple places. Yeah.
Well, that was our original idea as well. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, moving on to the second area then, which again is location, but it's kind of the opposite of what we just discussed, in that now we are talking about the concept of the board developing guidance or requirements about non-IFRS information in the financial statements. And similarly, this is a topic that we will be bringing back to the board for next step decisions. At the moment, we're intending to do that in June, but we've got a bit of work to do between now and then, because this was another area that was generally supported by those that commented and thought it was useful, but there are some interesting questions for us to think about before we move forward. The first one is around how, if we were to go down this route, non-IFRS information would be defined, and there is a couple of elements to what we're thinking about here. The first is that we had a lot of comments about the fact that IAS 1 does effectively require anything that is required to achieve fair presentation to be disclosed, which raises the question of, well, by definition then, is non-IFRS information the information that is not needed to give a fair presentation, and therefore should the board be getting involved here? So there's a question around that, and then there's also a question around defining non-IFRS information in the sense that something, if by definition it's not captured by IAS 1, how do we define the subset that is not required to achieve faithful representation but is so useful that the board should be capturing it in a definition and keeping it. We also had some views about the way that non-IFRS information was discussed in the DP, and generally respondents thought the board needed to particularly isolate information which is inconsistent and misleading from other information. Apart from defining non-IFRS information, the other big question for us here is something of a cost-benefit one, in the sense that a lot of companies do include non-IFRS information in the financial statements today. A lot of investors think that that is useful. And there is a question, therefore, about if the board were to do anything. Firstly, could it potentially cause harm if it were to possibly restrict companies that are already providing useful non-IFRS information from doing so? And secondly, does the board doing anything at all here meet the cost-benefit test in terms of would it be more helpful than potentially risky, given that something useful is happening today? So the questions on slide 21 are really around your advice about defining non-IFRS information in light of the information on the slides, and then secondly, what your views are on the information that is provided today and balancing that with the benefits of the board getting involved here. So with that, I will hand over for discussion.
Andrew.
Thank you. Yeah, definitions are tricky. and I do wonder if you need to develop specific definitions in this area. When we were developing our comment letter again, there was some confusion in the discussion around the interaction between this non-IFRS information and the discussion on APMs or MPMs. I think APMs, MPMs are dealt with elsewhere, so and that's probably the most sensitive aspect of what you might think of as non-IFRS information, but we can put that to one side for this discussion. There is this question about distinguishing non-IFRS information from additional information required to achieve a fair presentation, but I think it's possible to put too much stress on that. So I'd expect, going beyond the particular disclosures specified in standards, it's going to be fair. The additional information needed under paragraph 17 of IAS 1 is going to be quite limited and normally quite identifiable, and typically would relate to the implications of a particularly significant transaction that probably has some recognition and measurement consequences in the financial statements. Then there's a category of, as your presentation makes clear, a category of non-IFRS information that's there because it's specified by law or regulation, so we know that's above and beyond what's required by paragraph 17 of IS1 because it comes from elsewhere. And an example that was covered in our outreach was actually a large European brewing company that chooses to disclose the volume of beer sold. I think I understand that one. I don't think anyone's pretending that is required by IS1 either. So I think non-IFRS information is information beyond that is what's required by IFRS, including information to give a fair presentation. And the sorts of safeguards that are contemplated, we think, make a lot of sense. But to paraphrase what we call for in our letter, the safeguards should be proportionate to the risk that users will be confused or misled. And I think a lot of the situation, the examples I've given of information required by law or volume of beer sold, we don't see much scope for confusion to arise. So I think you can be quite principle-based in this area and try and kind of address those risks rather than trying to define particular subcategories and specify particular types of safeguard that apply to all those subcategories.
Linda?
Okay, so we've talked to a number of people about this particular nuance, and in this discussion, what became very interesting was this discussion, in particular, users wanted us to define what we meant by financial statements. And what we discovered in those conversations was, in this context, they assumed the MD&A, management commentary, was part of the financial statements. So just I'm going to tell you that nuance ahead of time before you think I've completely lost my mind. In these discussions, what became readily apparent was that the users don't necessarily differentiate between what is IFRS information and what is not what you would be calling non-IFRS information. And they also don't necessarily differentiate between the audited financial statements and the management commentary in terms of the assurance level that's provided. That's, I don't think, a new issue or a revolutionary issue, but it continues to exist. So in our jurisdiction, what our board has decided to do is we're working very quickly now to come up with some what we think will be non-authoritative guidance. Know how I've said we think will be non-authoritative guidance around what you would call alternative performance measures, whatever you want to call them. We're right now calling it corporate performance measures, at the end of the day, what we're finding is that if you, for instance, in our discussions, if you decide to allow non-IFRS information in the financial statements, you quickly work your way back to the same audit consideration, because the auditors are saying, well, if there's no standard for me to audit against, then how do I express an opinion on this other information that's in the financial statements? Whereas if it's restricted to management commentary, the requirement there is they read it to make sure it's not inconsistent with the financial statement, so they're not issuing an audit opinion. So long story short, massive confusion even in today's day and age about people actually understanding what's in one document versus another document, what's covered by the audit opinion, what's not. And so our users in these discussions said, well, if you're telling me that the audit opinion is only going to be over the financial statements, which means the statements and the notes, then don't let any non-IFRS information go in there, because now I'm not going to know whether it's covered by the audit opinion or not. So I know this is a circular discussion, but it's kind of the discussions that we've had. So I think the definition of terms outside of the whole notion of the IAS-1 include whatever you need to include to make a fair presentation, I think that's almost ancillary to these discussions. I think that you have to be very clear in what you mean by this. I think you still have audit considerations. And if nothing else, you have an education effort in terms of telling people what you mean by these various terms and what's included and not included.
Andreas.
Thanks, Hans. I wonder whether it would not make sense, building from what Linda and Andrew have said, to differentiate non-IFRS information further into non-IFRS accounting information and non-IFRS non-accounting information. Because it seems, looking into the beer example of Andrew, I think that is not potentially causing any worry, and it helps people to understand performance of their beer company, so why not including it? It doesn't appear to create a conflict with IFRS per se. However, if you're bringing in another regulatory framework that also works on financial reporting and you include those numbers in the IFRS financial statements, I can see the conflict, because then you enter potentially into the issue of inconsistency. The other point that I was going to make also goes back to Andrew. I think you probably ought to include in your Category C, or even make a Category D, of information that is required by law or regulation. So because that doesn't really tie into is it necessary or not. It's just regulator or the government that says you have to provide it exactly at this place.
Noble.
Yes, thank you. Our understanding is that financial statements provide a summary of the entity's financial performance and financial position, and accounting standards should prescribe the minimum information that should be provided by all entities. And in that context, if non-IFRS information were to be defined as information that is not necessarily needed to achieve a fair presentation, we think the principle should be that entities generally should not provide any non-IFRS information in its financial statements. But if entities nonetheless choose to provide such information, they should highlight such fact and possibly the reason why they included that information. We think it would be naive to think that users make decisions based solely on financial statements. And therefore, we don't think reduced disclosures of this non-IFRS information would lead to a loss of information, as entities still have other means of providing the information. So we think a narrower scope of IFRS information is acceptable.
Kimberly?
In terms of your first question about advice, how to define non-IFRS information, I think advice would be don't define it. We're certainly concerned about how you would operationalise that, particularly the differences between categories B and C. I even wondered what it would do from us from a standard setting perspective, because we have some mandatory additional disclosures in New Zealand and Australia. Would we then have to issue an interpretation about whether our additional disclosures are IFRS or non-IFRS? And given that we don't like doing interpretations, it would be quite ironic if you forced us to do it. So I think it causes a lot of headaches, really, going down that route. We would prefer that you focus more around principles of fair presentation, so some of the things that have already been discussed around any additional information not being misleading or biased. If it's inconsistent with IFRS, then identify what the basis of preparation is, why it's there. Is it there for regulatory purposes, for example? If it's voluntary provided, why it's being provided. If it's not part of the audited financial statements, clearly identified as not audited. Also wanted to disagree with the comment that you had on from one of the regulators, or from the regulators, saying that if it's not necessary to achieve a fair presentation, then it shouldn't be there, and if it is necessary, then IFRS should be changed to require it. Because some of that additional information might be helpful, but not necessary.
Yeah.
So why would we go down a path of saying, well, if it's not necessary, let's ban it, even if it happens to be helpful. And if it is helpful, suddenly change IFRS to require it when it may actually not be necessary. So I think that's a path that we don't really want to go down. And I think that again gets down to your third question about the risk. If we get really heavy-handed about this, then we're actually going to potentially reduce the usefulness of financial statements, as well as create a whole lot of problems with regulatory requirements that may actually require that the financial information be included, that information be included in the statutory financial statements.
Jim?
So, comments in a similar vein. Category A seems pretty clear. It's specifically required. B seems also to say it is required. So it's not specifically required, but required to comply with IFRS, and Category C is all things not required. So that seems to then say, well, if I provided a disaggregation beyond that which is specifically required in IFRS, it's somehow non-IFRS information. But it may be a very useful disaggregation. It could be specific compliance with the principles of IFRS, but I chose to disaggregate my loan-level detail into a little bit more than was specifically required to comply with IAS-1. So that seems now that's non-IFRS information or volume information about sales. Number of employees that equate to total remuneration is now non-IFRS information. Might actually prohibit people from providing useful information that doesn't seem inconsistent with IFRS. So that line seems pretty stark. And if the issue is really those things which are and even inconsistent, you wonder if it's inconsistent, why is it there? So I'm not sure that's the right label either, but the line just seems a little too bright to me that would actually, I think the question you're asking, does it actually, cost benefit wise, does it say don't even pursue then, or is there some other line that you're trying to identify?
Patrick?
Four quick comments. The first one is on terminology. For a poor English speaker, I'm wondering if non-IFRS is the best definition, because people would tend to interpret that as contrary to, which I think can be difficult. So I prefer something that's going in the direction of additional information or something like that. It's a bit like non-financial information. Non-financial information, we all know there is a whole spectrum of information. Some of it is almost financial, not required for financial reporting, but of a financial nature. Then you have the ones that are derived from the management systems, blah, blah, blah. And then you have the pure descriptive, qualitative ones. So non-IFRS, for me, is a negative. Of course, it's a negative definition, and I'm not sure I like negative definitions. The second comment is that I think there is an element of attracting
additional information into the virtuous circle of financial statements, i.e. allowing for more than the minimum. I prefer to have those information in the financial statements rather than outside the financial statements, wherever they can be located, because it is nobody knows where they are and nobody knows through what process they have been going. In the what I call the virtuous circle of financial statements, for me, there is an interest. It means quality. It means quality because it's audited, it's been approved by governments. Therefore, the attribute of that information is probably an attribute of quality. Of course, this is subject to guidance, which is my third comment, but the guidance should be in terms of principles. I do not drill down too much on the various elements. For me, the two principles are they shouldn't be contrary, that we said, to the IFRS information, in which because we would be in contradiction with the financial information, with the minimum financial information. And more positively, on this additional information, I think that a general recommendation of a balanced emphasis is needed. In other words, the risk with additional information is that you give more positive additional information than negative additional information because you are enthusiastic, etc. You want to present things positively. So a balance in the emphasis of the additional information is a general recommendation, which for me is that if you give an information, make sure that this one is true and fair, quote unquote, and is not presenting one aspect of reality. And last observation, allowing for additional information into the financial statements is some sort can lead to the best practices, and therefore can little by little improve the standard process when people will say, oh, at the end of the day, this information is very useful and shouldn't be left at the discretion of the entity, but rather required from the standard perspective.
You?
Thank you. First, I'd like to echo on Patrick's first comments. Since IS1, and also you mentioned that in IS1 requires that an entity to disclose additional information if necessary to achieve fair presentation. So we're also a little confused that if, could you please clarify whether the additional information here in IS1 refers to the non-IFRS information. If yes, then I agree with Patrick that we just use the additional information referred to in this area. If not, maybe you would like to have a separate definition of non-IFRS information. Although, personally, I think it would be helpful, but it's very challenging. It's very difficult to define the non-IFRS information. That's the first point. Second, in my opinion, that the boundary of the financial statement is relatively clear in the standards, for it refers to the financial statement, statement of financial position, the of income statement, the cash flow statement, and the notes. So I think the boundary is relatively clear. So when you would like to define the non-IFRS information, we think that would be narrow limited. So, which means it should we to avoid providing useless information to confuse users, we should be very careful to define this non-IFRS information. It should be limited. For example, something you just mentioned, that additional information necessary to comply with IFRS standards, or something helpful to help the users have a better understanding of financial statement, something required by national laws or regulations, some industry practice information, just very limited. Thank
you. I think you had a question within there that I might just comment on about the link between the information required by IAS 1 and what the board are thinking of as non-IFRS information. So the way that it was written in the discussion paper in terms of categories, and I would say the more prevalent view from everyone that we've talked to as well, is that the information that is required by Category 1 by IAS 1 would effectively fall within that Category B and B IFRS information, in the sense that it's not specifically required, but it is required to comply with IFRS, if that makes sense. So that's certainly the way that we've been thinking about it. And then the question about defining the term non-IFRS information is about the things that are in addition to that which is required by IAS 1, which would potentially be useful for the board to develop any guidance or requirements about.
Alberto?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, in my jurisdiction, companies provide a lot of IFRS or additional information by calling, but even too many, in my personal view. So the vehicle they use is the management commentary, which we call the director's report, for a number of reasons. One, because it needs not to be audited. The auditors only have to express a view that the information there is not in conflict with information in the financial statement. Now, the reason is because it contains a lot of opinions about what happened, what will happen, and so on in the business. And the legal consequences are less severe, because an opinion is opinion. You can't be accused to have said something false. Whereas a financial statement is a statement of facts, and there you may challenge it that you put you gave wrong information, false information. And there is a variety, incredible variety of non-IFRS information in this management commentary. And I wonder what information could be transferred from that document to the financial statement. At the moment, non-financial information in the financial statement are only those, I mean, by country, are only those which are required by law or by regulation, such as the director's remuneration, one by one, not the entire amount as required by IFRS. So each directors or key manager, we know exactly, and there are journalists which, at this point in time, you should make a list of who is the richest of all, you know. or the solvency ratio for insurance company, or the average number of employees, those are required by law or regulation. Not that nothing else is in financial data. As I said, in the management commentary, a lot of information. They are specific by industry and even different within the same industry. And I wonder how the board could in some way develop guidance, as you ask in this question number 3, unless you stay on very, very high level principles. I agree, non-IFRS information is a negative definition. But I wonder about additional information, because it's too positive. People say, well, if it's additional, it must be required. Therefore, you know, we have the same problem, perhaps. So,
Ilon?
Thank you.
As a AOSST, we received comments from four member jurisdictions. So most members thought that defining non-IFRS information consistently in accounting standards is difficult, and they say that the disclosure required under IFRS should be covered in the financial statements because the scope of IFRS is financial statements. And users usually get useful information outside financial statements, and they use financial statements as a reference document. And the definition of non-IFRS information in accounting standards might conflict with regulators' guidance on disclosure of non-financial information, and they suggested that the ISB clarify what can be cross-referenced and to where to minimize inconsistency rather than defining the non-IFRS information. And almost all members suggested that the ISB consider the audit implications of non-IFRS information in conjunction with the IAASB. Thank you.
Okay, Catherine.
Okay, I will then briefly summarise what we've heard there before moving on to the final topic. Firstly, thank you. We've got a lot of very useful feedback there, which I hope I will make a reasonable effort to do justice to in my brief summary. I couldn't write fast enough. So I think, once again, we've heard a lot of comments that demonstrate to us that the board are right to be taking some time to delve into this, because there are clearly some problems that we need to really think about before moving forward. I think generally the consensus in the room was consistent with our starting point in having some substantial concerns about how non-IFRS information would be defined, and indeed we've had some really interesting suggestions about whether we should do that at all, around the fact that having any kind of bright line might prohibit useful information, being too heavy-handed could reduce usefulness of the disclosures that are given, and we've had some suggestions around the fact that it might be better to go down a more principles of fair presentation-based approach rather than trying to give a specific definition. We also heard some concerns about potential translation issues and how non-IFRS might be heard as contrary to, which would certainly be problematic, and an alternative suggestion to consider thinking about additional information rather than non-IFRS information. And we also have some thoughts about potentially distinguishing between financial and non-financial information to try and deal with the risk of eliminating useful information from the financial statements when there's no risk to include in it. So there is a lot of feedback there for us to consider. A couple of other things that I will mention. We heard a couple of concerns again about audit, and just to let you know that this side of location is also within the scope of the research we're doing with the Auditing Standards Board, and that additional work. We also heard a concern at the end about potential conflict with local guidance from regulators about information that is in the financial statements, so that's another one that we will look into. And we also had some advice about potentially doing some education efforts around any terms that we do use and how they are used. So we will certainly use all of that as we prepare for moving forward on this one. So thank you. So with that, I will move on to the final topic in the principles of disclosure section. This one is about accounting policy disclosures. And again, this is an area that we plan to bring back to the board in June to talk about next steps, because we do want to do a bit of further work before we're ready to make those decisions. So specifically, the further research we're trying to do kind of relates to something of a timing issue, in the sense that we issued the Principles of Disclosure DP last March, and then in September, October, by which time we'd received most of the feedback we were going to receive, the board had done quite a lot of work with regard to materiality and the application of materiality, and published a couple of documents which since have received some very positive feedback about how useful they might be. So when we put those facts together with the feedback we got on the POD DP, which was generally that most respondents would want any guidance from the board about which accounting policies companies should be looking to disclose to be based on materiality, and applying materiality to accounting policy disclosures and deciding which ones are material, the board are in something of an interesting position now in terms of marrying together all the feedback we have on all of the different pieces of work they've done over the last year. So really the questions that we have for you are specifically around that link to materiality. So on slide 26, the questions are, do you think that the recently published documents, so the materiality practice statement and the better communications document, for example, will be useful to entities in deciding which accounting policies to disclose? In light of those publications, do you think there is still benefit in the board developing any further guidance around which accounting policies companies should disclose? And if they do decide to do that, in light of everything that's on the slides, do you have any particular advice about the approach that they might take, given that the categorised approach that was in the DP was generally not too popular? So with that, I will hand over for discussion of accounting policies.
Andreas.
Thanks, Hans. This is a difficult one, because there seem to be two schools of thought, certainly in my country and most likely elsewhere, where one school of thought would say, I treat the financial statements as a bibliography, and if that bibliography would also comprise all the accounting policy that pertain to my financial statements, whether material or not. So it's a holistic approach. My personal preference would be for something other, because I think in most of these cases there is no policy to be chosen. Policy for me, as per the semantic word, means it is a certain degree of discretion that I could exercise. And if there is no discretion, if I don't have any option, why should I disclose anything that the ISB clearly says you have to do this or that? So it's only when there is a degree of freedom in some sort. And that may be either a blunt accounting option, it may be an exercise of a judgment, something like that. And that then, I think, should be framed by materiality, because I would only make those disclosures if the amounts to which those accounting policies pertain are material. That will be my first preference. So get rid of virtually everything, unless I do have a degree of freedom and the amounts to which they apply are material. But I know that there is a different kind of school, so therefore I think it is difficult.
Andrew?
Thank you. Well, a few points. I'd agree with Andreas on all of this. I don't really think this is the biggest issue in the disclosure initiative, quite honestly. When the whole disclosure issue really kicked off 8 or 10 years ago, then I think perceptions about voluminous and boilerplate heavy accounting policy disclosures became perhaps symbolic of a wider set of concerns. But I think the messages around trying to make those disclosures more useful and concise and entity-specific have been heard by those who want to hear them. And considerable improvements have been made by a number of companies on the information they provide. In that said, I don't think this isn't criticising the materiality practice statement or the other best practice guidance that you produce, not at all, but I don't actually think it's particularly pertinent to deciding which accounting policies to disclose, because they have a different character. This is information explaining the base preparation of the information, which is the direct focus of that guidance. It is the, people use different phrases, but I'll use your phrase, the Category 3 information that seems to be the area of focus. I think the board could quite easily send some kind of signal as to whether for an explanation about the content of IFRS, as opposed to the choices a company has made in applying IFRS, but for the content of IFRS, a company need not provide that information because users can find it elsewhere. But as Andreas says, it's difficult and views are quite mixed. So if in the circumstances the board decided just to kind of leave it well alone, I'd understand that.
Nolan?
I have 3 points. The first is, under Japanese GAAP, accounting policy disclosures are required only when there's a choice, and I think it's functioning very well. My second point is that preparers have told us that they have difficulty understanding how users use this disclosure, and therefore it would be difficult for them to consider which information is necessary to actually achieve the objective of this disclosure. The third point is that if any guidance is to be provided on this point, we think it should be a mandatory requirement because it pertains to the entity's actions rather than the ISP's actions.
Kimberly?
I think your first question about were the documents or the work that's already been done around materiality, will it be helpful? I think yes, it will be. You know, particularly the report on the case studies of what entities have done, so people can see some real life examples. I personally would not support some of the suggestions that have been made that would lead to changes to IS1's requirements to disclose all material accounting policies, which includes situations where there isn't a choice. I mean, IS1 emphasises it's more likely to be material if there's a choice, but certainly my understanding is that even if there isn't a choice, if it's a material accounting policy, it is required to be disclosed. And, you know, wouldn't support removing that requirement because I don't think it's reasonable to expect users of financial statements to delve into IFRS standards. And therefore, I think they do need those material accounting policies. I don't think there's anything more that you need to do in terms of providing further guidance on materiality. I think what's been done is sufficient, and really it's about changing behaviours. So for those entities that are continuing to provide voluminous accounting policies, including accounting policies that are not material or not even applicable to the company. You know, you get some entities that put everything that they could possibly need in the next 50 years into their accounting policy disclosures if they're in a compliance mindset where they want to avoid the risk of forgetting to add it in if they ever come across that transaction. If people are in a compliance mindset, I don't think there's anything that more that you can do to change it. I think those that are willing to change their mindset and focus on effective communication, you know, our experience in New Zealand and Australia is that those entities that are in that mindset have already got all the tools that they need to make their financial statements more effective. So those that are in the compliance mindset, I don't think, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink at the end of the day. So I don't think there's any more work that you need to do in this space.
Linda?
So I just have two points that I want to make. One is that in our discussions on this topic, we think that the items on slide 25 would be helpful. But we don't think that the volume of accounting policy disclosure is the main problem, certainly that we observe. We actually think the quality of this disclosure, I'm going to reinforce what Andrew said, and the fact that it's not entity-specific. And so just as an example, in our domestic standards we write for private enterprises, we've done a post-implementation review of our financial instrument standard, and it is a simpler version of what appears in IFRS, but we included some risk-based disclosures as requirements. And when we did the post-implementation review, everybody complained about those and said nobody understood them and why did we have them and that sort of thing. So what we did is we had the staff actually come up with some live examples of what we thought entity-specific disclosures would look like versus the boilerplate that just repeat the words of the standard. And we put those in front of users. And in this case, the users would largely be fund providers, so bank users who are granting loans, but other people who are giving funds to these entities. And we said, could you tell us which of these disclosures? And we had them color code them. Green were, you know, the most useful, and yellow were kind of marginal, and red would be they'd never find them of interest. And in the entity-specific examples, we got no red. We got the majority of green and a little bit of yellow, but we got no red. And so that what that taught us is that we actually needed to issue some guidance, which we're working on right now, around what does entity-specific disclosure mean, so that we can hopefully raise the bar on these disclosures. And I think in accounting policy disclosures, you get too often just using the words of a specific IFRS standard as opposed to the entity saying, this is how we've actually applied this standard in the production of our financial statements. So that's one point. And that's a hurdle because entities sometimes don't want to use that language, or their securities lawyers don't like it because they think it causes risk or whatever. But, you know, I think it's worth fighting the battle. The other thing I would just mention is that you have to remember that these financial statements are often incorporated by reference for other filings. So if you issue a prospectus, you incorporate your financial statements by reference to meet securities law. And so I would urge you not to make anything mandatory about omitting certain accounting policies, because in fact by securities law you may need to have the broader view of accounting policies to make sure you're meeting the prospectus requirements. So just keep that idea in your mind as you're going about this process.
Jim?
So I thought the categories were interesting when you compare them against the prior discussion. Specifically, I think category three here would be non-IFRS information. That is, if you chose to disclose an accounting policy, it wouldn't be required. The previous section said those things that aren't required are non-IFRS, so it would be, I think, some interaction there, so I'm happy to hear you're probably not moving down the categories. And I think the discussion by Linda is a helpful one about not limited to those things where there's a choice, but actually how have you applied the standard to those material areas. And I take revenue recognition as a good example. I think you see oftentimes boilerplate discussion that says we recognize revenue, take under the new standard when control transfers. Well, that's probably not helpful. That's what's required by IFRS. But when does control transfer within your facts and circumstances? Is it point in time or is it over time? And that's not a choice, but it might be a judgment. And so how have you applied that standard against the judgments in your fact pattern? And I can see that being very useful to users of saying, I manufacture a good for which control transfers over time. My competitor might do a very similar good, but their contracts are such that it transfers at point in time. And so you need to know how does that standard apply in your facts and circumstances. And I think that's more, to me, educational. There's been a lot of work done around that. So it's not as clear to me that you need a standard versus continued effort at education about how to apply the standards to those fact patterns. I also think there's an interaction between this and the cross-referencing, perhaps. And again, if you think out, you know, a number of years, do you really need a static document that you issue every period with the disclosures or the policies, or can you cross-reference to more of an evergreen file? That these are my disclosures, they're incorporated into, or these are my disclosures about policies, they're incorporated into my financial statements. If you want to see them, go look here, and then those are just kept up to date on an ongoing basis. And maybe that's more responsive to the, you know, every year I republish the same set of things and only two or three of the policies change. Well, users might want to know that, but they probably could also look in an evergreen file.
You know?
Thank you. Regarding application of materiality to accounting policy disclosures, AOSS members showed mixed views. So one member was unsure the additional guidance was necessary because judgment still needs to be applied. And one member noted that the materiality practice statement does not provide examples where materiality is applied when determining which accounting policy should be disclosed. So they suggested including such example in the materiality practice statement.
Just a quick response to these questions. First, the documents on slide 25 are very helpful, and it would also be very helpful for the board to develop some further guidance on the application of materiality to accounting policy disclosures in the project of principle of disclosure. And I also agree with Linda that the entity-specific disclosure is very important. Currently, the accounting policy disclosure section in the financial statement look almost the same, and many users have complaints about that.
Okay. Time for summing up.
Yes, sum up on the discussion about accounting policies. So on the recent publications around materiality first, we have heard a few mixed views there. So we had a couple of opinions that those documents are useful in their application to deciding which accounting policies to disclose, and in fact potentially nothing more on the application of materiality is needed. For those that are not in a compliance mindset may well have enough from what is in those publications already. We did hear a view that the materiality practice statement is not so relevant in terms of applying it to accounting policies as in, rather than applying it to other elements of the financial statements. We've also heard a couple of views that it would be useful for the board to give a bit more there, for example, by developing some accounting policy specific guidance within the materiality practice statement. So some differing opinions there that we will certainly think about. I think one of the key messages coming through for us in terms of potential other ways of going about this that the board might consider is around focusing very much on choices and entity specific considerations around how IFRS requirements have been applied. So we've heard that focusing on areas where companies have a choice is already working in Japan, and we've heard thoughts around the fact that things that are just repeated every year aren't necessarily so relevant and might be better dealt with via interaction with cross-referencing, but the area where perhaps a real positive difference could be made would be by encouraging improvement in behaviour around focusing on the entity-specific areas. So we will take that on as we move this area forward.
Okay, that brings us to the end of this discussion. I think you've given us a lot to chew on. Staff and board members will do. We reconvene at 2:00.